Sairam, dear listeners, welcome to today's afternoon satsang. We will be continuing where we left off last week in our discussion on one of the modes of worship, one of the Navvida Bhakti Margas, which is Vandanam. Before we get into the topic proper, we would like to place our humble obeisances, our Vandanam, at the lotus feet, at our beloved Bhagwan's lotus, at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And I welcome Prem, who will be part of this satsang, as always. Before we begin what we are going to discuss today, today's is going to be the most more important discussion of the two, if I can say so, because today we will be going into how Swami has uniquely and beautifully interpreted Vandanam. He has defined what Vandanam is for us, so we will be going into that. But before we go into that, a quick recap of what has happened so far. Last week we saw how Vandanam is a step above Padasevanam, and therefore it is placed as fifth. We also discussed why Vandanam is coming before Archanam in Swami's Navvida Bhakti Marga, because in the traditional Navvida Bhakti Marga it is Padasevanam, Archanam and then Vandanam. So that was the other discussion we had. After that, in Vandanam also we explored the different kinds of Vandanam. The most superficial and normal kind of Vandanam is a kind of respect that one professional has towards another. A little deeper Vandanam is like the regards and reverence that a student has towards the teacher. And the absolute Vandanam, where it is complete surrender, as we can see in the case of a Shishya and a Guru, a disciple and a Guru. So this is what we had discussed in great detail with examples. And now we shall proceed. And yeah, Sairam Prem, I hope that we have an enlightening discussion.
Yes, Arvind, and it's when we go into Swami's discourses, we see why so many times Swami refers to the Navavida Bhakti Marga itself, because it's such a comprehensive concept in itself. Each one of these, yeah, this is the second episode we're doing in this particular aspect of the Navavida Bhakti Marga, but we have managed to do two episodes in each one of them, and still we dare say we are comprehensive. And that shows, you know, how much is there. And many times when we speak about Navavida Bhakti Marga, and especially this path we're talking about, Vandanam, and the example which Swami gives, Akrura, we would be lost. You know, who is, you know, what is so special about this personality from the Mahabharata that Swami has to dedicate one of the nine paths? You know, there are not 900, there are only nine. And one is given to this obscure personality from the Mahabharata. Of course, a noble soul nevertheless.
All of these questions. I think last week we even went into his life.
We even went into his life. And there is so much to all of this. One thing which we've seen in all the paths is, of course, how each one of them start in a superficial level but can go deeper, be it Shravanam, Kirtanam or Padasevanam. I think that's the same thing with Vandanam too. If I'm not wrong, it's the 1979 summer course where Swami spoke about the different types of obeisance. You know, obeisance is another word which we use for Vandanam or Namaskar,
salutations,
or salutations or whatever it is. So in that in context, when Swami was speaking, Swami said there are three types of obeisances. And Swami said it is called Patha, Nipata and Pranipata. Pranipata, I think, is a word which we might have heard elsewhere, especially it's there in that Gita Shloka which gets immortalized in the Shirdi Satcharitra, where, you know, Nana Chandolkar is reciting
Nana Sahib,
right, he's reciting a verse from the Gita, you know, Pranipate na sevaya, tadviddi seya pranipate na sevaya,
tadviddi pranipate na, yes, I
understand. So yeah, there that word pranipata comes, you know, and
the tadviddi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya.
Pariprashnena sevaya.
Yes.
And of course the discussion is about pariprashna. But pranipata is the word which means doing sashtang namaskar. So that's the word. But what about patha nipata? Swami goes on to explain. Patha is just bowing down and touching the feet. and bowing down alone, Nipata is probably a little more effort where you touch the feet of the person, and Pranipata is when you do a Sashtanga, you know, and each one of it has a spiritual meaning to it.
Sashtanga means with all the eight limbs of the body,
right?
You sleep completely on your stomach, you know, right. In that way, yeah. And that is Sashtanga Namaskar.
This Pranipata has the meaning of Sashtanga. At the same time, it also means surrender. When you surrender, it's called Pranipata. The discussion which we had last week, I think more or less fits into these three in many ways than one. You know, we spoke about how you first have a respect. You know, when you're a cultured person, you tend to have respect for any person of any achievement. You know, you might be a singer, but you meet a doctor, but you respect him for the achievements in his field. So you don't really have a feeling of obeisance there, but there is a feeling of respect. I think that comes under Pata. And
it's more like between equals.
Right, more between equals. But Nipata is when you don't touch the feet of everybody. You have a certain amount of reverence to that person. So it's probably from respect to reverence. But when you talk about Pranipata, you kind of surrender everything, you know, all your decision making, all your likes and dislikes, and what you're supposed to do with your life, you surrender to that person. And that comes under Pranipata. But an interesting thing is, you know, this word Nipata actually has another meaning in Sanskrit. Nipata also means to fall.
Oh, to slip and fall.
Right, slip and fall is also called Nipata. So in other words, I think some of the incidents we narrated last week was, you know, when people who came to Swami, that typical genre of people who, you know, who came and who were conquered, who came, they saw and they got conquered. It's probably like this Nipata, you know, you come with a haughty head, but you see who's in front of you, and then it's almost like you trip and fall.
To put in other words, you never intended to fall at the feet, but you tripped.
You bowled over.
Swept off your feet.
And that's the term, the perfect term. I think that's what is Nipata. Sometimes you willingly fall at the feet. Sometimes you're just, as you said, swept off your feet and you fall at the feet. But Pranipata is completely different, where, you know, we spoke of it last time too, you know, where you say that, no, it's not that when I need a decision I come to you, it's not that when I need help I come to you, but I will do whatever you say, you know, you direct the course of my life. It's almost like what Lakshmana went through, you know, the devotion which Lakshmana symbolized.
So that is Pranipata, which we also gave a synonym as Sashtanga Namaskar. You know, it's amazing when we read Swami's literature, we get so much more inner meaning, and I will make an effort to restrain myself and hold myself before revealing how actually Sashtanga Namaskar is complete surrender. And it's not me revealing, it is Swami revealing and clearing our doubts, because all these are picked up from Swami Sandeha Nivarini. Which incidentally, it's very interesting, I think if our listeners are not aware, we should make them aware that this Sandeha Nivarini is a series of spiritual questions and doubts asked by devotees and answered by Swami. That is how the whole book is compiled as question answers. And one thing which is amazing is, Prem, you know, when yesterday I was going through once again, you get great respect and reverence and, you know, adoration for Swami, no doubt. But you also get great reverence for the devotee, because the devotee is able to throw away all materialistic desires and questions and answers and simply focus on the spiritual. You know, it feels like a true jignyasu. It feels like a conversation between a jignyasu and a jnani. As Lord Krishna classifies his devotees, a jignyasu and a jnani. And of course, Swami is a jnani, and this is a real jignyasu. And it is really amazing when we know the reason why we get so much reverence for the devotee and why the devotee is a jignyasu.
Right, absolutely. Because the entire book has been written by Swami, the questions framed by Swami and the answers delivered by Swami himself. But you know, the first time when I read the book Sandeha Nivarini and I got to know that it's been written by Swami this way, it really filled a little bit of fear in me, because that is what Swami expects of us. You know, when you want to ask, when you want to become a seeker at his feet, that is the level of, Shraddha, earnestness, at the same time the level at which your questions must be. No, we are so stuck with that. I remember when we were students, every time Swami would give us this opportunity, you have any doubts, you can ask. I think invariably the question was, Swami, how to control the mind, how to control the thoughts.
What is faith? You know,
right. It used to be very rudimentary.
Superficial also.
Yeah, superficial, because, you know, the opportunity is in front of you and you have to grab the opportunity, otherwise you will feel bad. At the same time, you know, you have to strike a conversation. You can't ask a question which will have a one-line answer or a one-word answer. So all of this, it's not definitely coming from a burning aspiration to know. But when you read Sandeha Nivarani, you know that, oh God, this is what you have to ask Swami if you get the opportunity. That's what Swami expects of an aspirant.
I think one important point you made there is about the burning aspiration to know. Because even as we were discussing this, the analogy that came to my mind is, what if a super scientist, say like Einstein, walks into your classroom and you are in primary school and you ask him questions based on your level. So I felt that is what possibly we did to Swami. But after you made that statement, it hit me that it doesn't matter if the level of our questions are not up to the level of the Lord. I mean, in the sense, of course, the Lord is at the ultimate level. It's like, as I said, a primary school student asking questions of Einstein. But what is more important is, whether we are in primary school or higher secondary school or university, I feel the question that we ask must not be for the heck of asking a question or for the sake of just occupying time, but it must arise from that burning desire to know the answer, without knowing which I feel incomplete. I don't feel like having food. I don't feel like spending the day because I'm feeling incomplete because I don't know this answer. I think that was what even Shirdi Baba in the Satchachitra defined as the difference between Prashna and Pariprashna.
In fact, one of the commentaries I read about that shloka, it says, you know, when I read that commentary, I felt how lucky we are, because it says, you know, first of all, Pranipata actually comes first, because the first thing an aspirant needs to do is find a guru who is worth surrendering to.
Hmm.
He said, after finding the guru worth surrendering to, then surrender. You know, after having done that, it's easy to do seva, it's easy to ask questions, because you don't mind feeling stupid, I mean appearing stupid in front of the guru, because here is a guru who is genuinely interested in your progress. So he says the first thing is you have to find a guru who is worth surrendering to. And when I read that, you know, half the journey is complete if you find a guru like that, and we are lucky in that manner. We have found Swami who is more than worth our surrender, you know.
Or rather, in many cases, he has found us.
Right, absolutely. So, and that is what the question comes from, that burning desire to know. In fact, I'm reminded of an analogy which happens in a master's satsang. You know, there are all these people sitting and they're all asking questions. He's of course an Advaitic guru. So all of them are asking all these phenomenal questions. Suddenly a man walks into this gathering and he sits quietly in a corner. After about 15-20 minutes, he puts up his hand. So the master looks at him and says, yes, what's your question? He asks a question, the answer to which many people in the gathering would know. Because all of us are well read, you know, we're all theoretical bookworms in that sense. So this person asks a question which is probably very simple and anybody could have answered. But the guru gives one particular answer, you know, one particular interpretation of that answer. So this man listens to the answer, looks into empty space, and just gets up and walks away without a word. And the master looks at him and smiles and looks at everybody around and says, this guy is over.
This guy is over meaning, yeah, his
for him, it's
journey
done.
Is done.
Huh. He says his journey is done. And everybody is wondering, you know, how, all of us know the answer to that question. And how is it that just receiving that answer, he was done? He said, because, you know, he had answered all the questions and this was the only question which was lacking. And his, you know, there was a burning desire to know the answer. So once the answer was given, his journey is done. So that burning desire,
that pining, the example which we often have narrated here of Krishnamurti, who pined to see Swami's feet, such that even without actually seeing his feet, he got ultimate merger, in comparison to many of us who have seen the feet, possibly have touched it also, and yet not much seems to have impacted us. So we move ahead with the discussion to what in the beginning I promised would be the crux, because this is how Swami interprets Vandanam. Before we get into a satsang and discussion on that, I think it's best that we listen to what Swami has said on what is true Vandanam.
And this is a clip from the discourse which Swami gave in 16th of May 2002 during the summer course in Vrindavan.
ఏమిటి ఈ నమస్కారం యొక్క అంతరాత్మ
వాట్ ఇస్ ఇన్నర్ సిగ్నిఫికెన్స్
ఐదు కర్మేంద్రియములు ఐదు జ్ఞానేంద్రియములు ఈ ఐదు చేరి పదేంది ఇంద్రియములు ఈ దశేంద్రియములు హృదయం దగ్గర పెట్టుకుని ఇది నమస్కారం ఇవి హృదయానికి చేరాలి చేరి అప్పుడు నమస్కారం అంటే ఇది పవిత్రమవుతుంది
నమస్కారం అండ్ ది యూనియన్ కాంబినేషన్ ఆఫ్ ఫైవ్ సెన్సెస్ ఆఫ్ కాగ్నిసెన్స్ అండ్ ఫైవ్ సెన్సెస్ ఆఫ్ యాక్షన్ బోత్ టెన్ టుగెదర్
నమస్కారం అని చెప్పాలి
అండ్ యూ హ్యావ్ టు డూ నమస్కార హోల్ హార్టెడ్లీ
కానీ మీరెవరు పోలేదేమో ఇంకా ఆంధ్ర వైపున ఈ ఆంధ్ర వైపున పోతే నమస్కారం అండి ఏమిటి నమస్కారం నమస్కారం రెండు కూడా చేతి కూడా చేదు నమస్కారం అండి గొడ్డలతో కొట్టినట్టుగా వచ్చింటుంటుంది నమస్కారం
దే డు నమస్కార్ యాజ్ ఇఫ్ దే ఆర్ అప్లైయింగ్ యాక్ట్స్ ఆన్ ద బాడీ ఇట్స్ నాట్ సో
నమస్కారము
నమస్కారం
రెండు కూడాను రెండు దక్షిణాంగుష్టం ఇచ్చిన దాన చేసి బాణ సంధాన లాగో భంగమయ్యే ఎరుకు విలువిద్య కలిమికి ఈనుడయ్యే పార్థునకు మనోహరతైన పాసేంత ఈ రెండు కూడాను చాలా ప్రధానమైనటువంటి ఒక తంబులు
ద థమ్ ఇస్ వెరీ ఇంపార్టెంట్ బోత్
ఇదే దైవంతో సమానము
దట్స్ డివైన్
ఈ వేద కుటీ లేకపోతే ఎన్ని వేలు ఉంటే కూడా ప్రయోజనం
వితౌట్ ద థమ్ ద ఫోర్ ఫింగర్స్ ఆర్ యూస్
ఈ దశేంద్రియములు కలిపి
విత్ ఆల్ ద టెన్ సెన్సెస్
ఈ రెండు తమ్ములు హృదయానికి పెట్టుకుని
అండ్ జాయినింగ్
ఇది నమస్కారం అని చెప్పాలి
అండ్ దెన్ డు నమస్కార
హృదయం నుంచి వచ్చేటువంటి నమస్కారం
అండ్ ఇట్ షుడ్ కమ్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ ద హార్ట్
దేర్ స్వామి సేస్ దట్ ది ఫైవ్ ఫింగర్స్ ఆన్ వన్ హ్యాండ్ రిప్రజెంట్ ది కర్మేంద్రియస్ The five fingers on the other hand represent the Jnanendriyas. So Namaskaram is when the Karmendriyas and Jnanendriyas come together, not at any other place, but right in front of the heart, touching the heart. So it's a heartfelt gesture when these come together in the presence of the heart, and with humility your tongue speaks out the word Namaskaram. That is true Vandanam, Swami says. And, Prem, I think the rest of this satsang, we can just discuss on this, because first of all, I think we should try to understand what are Karmendriyas, what are Jnanendriyas. They are often translated as the five senses of, the five organs of perception and the five organs of action. So what are these? Now, what does the heart stand for? What does the Hridayam stand for? What does the tongue stand for? I think if we just understand these based on what Swami has said in the discourses itself and what Swami has said in the Sandeha Nivarini, I think we will be elevated a few notches higher in our understanding of Vandanam.
In all of these concepts, especially about these Jnanendriyas and Karmendriyas, if you look at it, and not to put anybody down, but if you read Western philosophy, especially about psychology, if you read, you will find that, how deep these people have already gone much before man started wondering about the mind, the Western man, about psychology and about the human mind. Because there is so much of detail in the way they've described the human body and the mind and how it's connected and what is the purpose of human life. And when we speak about Vandanam, as, whether you speak of the ultimate stage as surrender, which is probably the ultimate in bhakti, or the ultimate stage is giving up your ego, which is another explanation which Swami gives. We'll come to that later. It means that using all the faculties which is in your which
control,
is given to you, using it to attain this state. And Swami says that when you do Vandana, when you do that to a person in front of you, or when you do that to a person who is who you look up to as guru or an avatar or whatever it is, the idea is to reach that state. And Swami says when you do the Vandanam here, as we heard, Karmendriyas and Jnanendriyas. Probably we'll start with the Karmendriyas. That's easier to understand, and I think most of us will know it. Karma means action, and Indriya means the senses or equipments, in other words.
Equipment, yes. So, forgive me, Prem, I just felt that
starting
it's easier to start with Jnanendriyas,
right,
because
we'll start with the Jnanendriyas,
that
right.
is what I understand easier. Swami defines Jnanendriyas as the inner senses in, this is as per the Sandeha Nivarini. So he describes the Jnanendriyas as the inner senses. They're also called the organs of perception.
Right.
So basically these are like input devices, very easy to understand. So the five Jnanendriyas or the organs of perception are the eyes, which see and input sight into us, the ears which hear and input sounds, the nose which smells and therefore inputs the various fragrances or stinks, odors basically, the tongue which can taste and therefore inputs flavors, and the skin which touches and therefore which inputs how things feel. So these are the five input devices or the five organs of perception which are called Jnanendriyas. That is the eyes, ears, nose, tongue and skin. And in the similar vein, therefore, the Karmendriyas are called organs of actions. They are the output devices. And I must say that, you know, when we give so much importance to speaking and Namasmarana, we can understand, because the tongue is the only input-output device, you know. It is the only indriya which can do both.
Right.
So, the tongue, or specifically they consider the larynx as one of the organs of action, as a karmendriya. Because though it is the tongue that speaks, the voice seems to be emerging from the larynx. So whatever, the tongue is one of the karmendriyas also. Now apart from the tongue, the second is the hands, which do action, which do multiple kinds of actions. The feet, which is the third karmendriya. The fourth karmendriya is the excretory organ, because that is also giving an output. And the fifth karmendriya is the reproductive organ, because that also gives output. So, once again, the five output devices or the five karmendriyas, the organs of actions, are the tongue, the hands, the feet, the excretory organ, and the reproductive organ.
And I wonder what it means to bring these two together when Swami says, when you offer namaskar. Again, it is the thing which we mentioned the last time. When you offer namaskar to anybody, it means that you're offering namaskar to the God within.
Hmm.
So whether you're respecting the person, you're respecting the person's talent or whoever it is, the act of doing namaskar is always meant to the divinity within. So I think we'll take it from there, saying that this bringing together of the Karmendriyas and Jnanendriyas is a way of offering obeisance to divinity.
Again, based on what Swami has written in the Sandeha Nivarini, you know, how it occurred is, Prem, see, we have output devices, we have input devices, we have the keyboard, which is an input device, we have the monitor, which is an output device. But these two as such are lifeless, they are useless, they are good for nothing, though they have so much capability. What makes them useful is the CPU, the central processing unit in the computer. So too, Swami says that while the Jnanendriyas, the input devices, are the inner senses, and the Karmendriyas or the output devices are the outer senses, what activates them and makes them useful is something what Swami refers to as the innermost senses, which are also called as the Antakarana. So I think we should also understand what this Antakarana is. Antakarana, basically, if you translate it roughly, it just means the innermost device, innermost mind. Because Swami defines Karana as the mind, and Antaha means innermost. So there is something called the innermost mind, which behaves like a CPU for these input and output devices. And Swami says that just like a CPU brings the input and output devices together, in order to understand what it means to get Karmendriya, Jnanendriya together, we need this CPU, which the Swami doesn't use the term CPU, I am using it, but we need the Antakarana. So I think we should also understand what the Antakarana is.
One example which Swami gives, and in fact it's a very scientific example. If you just go by the input of the eye, they say that what actually your eye takes in, just what the eye takes in is actually, let's say that you're sitting in front of me, Arvind is sitting in front of me. What the eye takes in is an image of you, which is about less than an inch long, tall, and which is inverted.
Absolutely.
Right, that's what actually reaches the eye. But it is when this goes into the mind, it gets processed, it gets inverted again.
It gets interpreted.
Right, interpreted, and you know, the mind also says that here is Arvind and I'm doing a satsang with him, and I have to respond to what he says. So this idea of what is the scene in front of me is complete only when there is something which is processing these multiple inputs. It's exactly. not only the eye. And in fact, we don't realize this. It's scientifically being spoken of now, that the amount of input the skin gives is actually very subtle and lost most of the time. Hmm. Actually, the idea of the spatial representation of the things in front of you is actually observed by the skin. You know, what is the distance between the various objects in the room and you?
Hmm.
The spaciousness of the room, whether there is congestion or whether it's an open space. All of this, much of it is actually taken by the skin's perception of the place you are in.
The other day I was having a discussion with my wife. And I was telling her, if you are told that among the five organs, at that time I was not aware of Karmendriya, Jnanendriya as such. In the sense, I have heard these terms, but I didn't know that Karmendriyas are this. I just felt, five Karmendriyas, five Jnanendriyas. So I was asking her, if among the five senses you have to give up something, which would you give up? So this was the discussion we were having. And I was thinking that the most important are the eyes. Eyes are first most valuable for me. And when I put the things in order, for me, the bottom two were skin and smell. Feeling and smelling. I felt like even if I can do, if I can't smell also, it's fine. It is only after I decided that they're not important, like how they say, when you lose something, you learn its value.
Mm-hmm.
I just researched into what all we lose when we lose out on smell. If you lose out on smell, you lose out on taste as well.
All your flavors, right?
All your flavors are gone. That is on the smell part. And the touch, what you were saying. You know, when I'm standing on my feet, it is because of the skin on my soles that I'm able to balance myself.
Right.
There's a lot of information that is being conveyed, which my CPU, my antakarana, is utilizing to help me stand balancing. That's why if my skin goes dead, I may not be able to balance. I may not be able to, you know, feel heat. In fact, it is life-saving, you know. So many times when the temperature goes high, you know, it is when your body temperature has to be regulated. It is because of the skin messages are sent that the thermoregulation in the body begins. If some fire touches and your things are getting, you know, burnt out, it is the skin that tells you this emergency, dial 911, run out of here, all this. Life-saving it is, the skin. So, when we look at it, it is not as such the skin that is doing. Like you said, the eye is just sending an image. That is why it is said that many times we are deluded. For example, something which is seen as orange by the eye, when placed in collaboration with other colors, it appears different.
Right.
Because there is a brain processing that is going on. In fact, based on the images sent by each eye independently, the brain is able to analyze and actually tell us which object is front, which object is back. The eye is actually not telling that.
Right.
In fact, they have done experiments to show that if you shut one eye, your depth perception goes away. You're not able to perceive which is further away, which is closer. The depth perception is because of two eyes sending separate signals. So there is an interpretive mechanism that makes sight useful. Otherwise, it's as good as taking a photograph, you know, that's all.
Yeah.
But just with sight, we get so many things. We get memories. We look at something and we are reminded of somebody else. We smell something and we are reminded of something else. All these kind of associations is what is built by the CPU. And therefore, as we stated earlier, it's so important that we get to know the CPU.
And the other thing which Swami would usually say is, you know, we've seen that, let's say a person dies, many times we see they die or they pass away with their eyes open. And if you look at the eyes just as a lens, this whole process is still going on. You know, light falling into this the lens in front.
Falling on the retina. Yes.
Falling on the retina, the inversion of the image. Because this is just optics. You know, you don't need life in your eyes for this to happen. This process of light falling into the eye and eating the optical nerve happens.
And probably, that is why they're able to even transplant the eyes.
Right. And probably even neurons are firing. Because it's again a photoelectric effect, you know, light falling on a set of electrons in something, it's fired off. But there is something which is lost inside.
There is no sight.
Something which has stopped working inside, because of which even the Karmendriyas and being there, I'm sorry, the Jnanendriyas being there, nothing is happening inside. And Swami says, you know, that's what we call these antakarnas, because something is processing it and making this entire entity alive.
Animating it, yes.
Right.
Because even the hand is there, but the hand that, you know, that could give you, lend you a helping hand, now becomes a burden. In fact, from practical experience I say, I have carried a person, a live person. I have also carried a body. And you know, it is so amazing that a body seems to get so heavy. So heavy. It is not as if its physical weight has increased. Just the fact that even if it's a sleeping person, a live person seems to be giving some kind of a cooperation when you lift him or her.
Right.
Which a dead person doesn't give. You know, it's amazing how life can make something lighter and death can make something heavier. What is that? Because it's amazing that hand that could lend a helping hand now becomes so heavy to carry also. So definitely there is something magical beyond just the input-output device, and that is the Antahkarana. And having stated that term so many times, the Antahkarana is constituted by four things. We will go into those also. The four things are Manas, Buddhi, Chitta and Ahankara. I think we should understand what each of these is and what functions they perform in the functioning of our CPU.
Right. I think plainly put, in very, very mundane terms, we're talking about the mind. But that's why I said, you know, the amount of study they've done on the human mind, our ancients, it's so amazing, because much of the functioning of the human mind in our day-to-day life is explained just by these, you know, four antakarnas, or the division of the mind into these four antakarnas, where, you know, manas is often translated as the working mind. It's not the thinking mind, it's the working mind. For instance, for everything, like it's just that for everything you need a certain amount of mind. Let's say I'm thirsty, I just need to take a glass of water and drink. Just for the act of lifting the glass of water and putting it in my lip and sipping, you need a certain amount of mind. You don't need thinking for that, but you need a mind to coordinate this entire effort, which is actually, if you know engineering and if you know mechanics, it's a lot of processes. One after the other, it's innumerable number of processes. If you have to write coding for that, you'll go crazy. But there is this mind which is so smoothly coordinating this entire thing. And that's called the working mind, which is translated as manas.
Yeah, even things like brushing our teeth.
Right.
Doing mundane things, you know, just laying the head down when we are feeling tired.
I mean, it's like a decision has been made. And to execute that decision, you need a certain mind.
Suppose it's the executive. Yes.
I choose to throw something at you right now. The decision is made, but to complete that act, I need this working mind, which is called the manas.
That is a manas. Now, there are some situations where the manas can't do things on its own. You know, I feel like in an office, we have something called petty cash. For small, small things when you need to do, you just, without even thinking, like how they say, without even thinking, you do it. Yeah, you spend. But if the amount of expenditure incurred is beyond a certain thing, you have to refer. So, there are other parts of the mind in this Antahkarana which the working mind or manas refers to when it is facing a dilemma or when it has a decision to make. And one such thing is the buddhi. Buddhi is, in English it is translated as intellect. It is supposed to be the discriminatory center which discriminates between right and wrong, good and bad and all this. And therefore, in times of doubt, when a decision has to be made, the most important part of the mind which the manas refers to is called the buddhi, which is discrimination or intellect. So that is the second part of the mind.
And then probably a thing to add is, you know, the difference which Swami says between animal and man is, for the animal, most of it remains in the manas aspect. Now, most of it is automated. When it has
instinct.
To sleep, yeah. When it has to hibernate, when it has to procreate, all of it is almost timed to, you know, clockwork precision. It all happens automatically. Swami would often say that, you know, a dog which is sick will not eat even if you put its favorite food in front of it, because it knows it's kind of programmed inside that when the stomach is not fine, it has to not eat this food. It has to go and eat a particular grass, and you will see this in many animals. In fact, I think there's that documentary about those salmons, right, which swim across the ocean, Pacific Ocean, go
yes,
back
and
to the place,
swim upriver also.
Upriver, you know, to the place where they actually were born, and without knowing where that exact place is, they will go to the exact that particular place of the river,
they will navigate
to that.
When you were saying that, you know, Prem, I was thinking, just like an animal knows, like how you said, Swami says that a dog will not eat its favorite food when it's feeling sick. We also have that instinct. But sadly, we use our buddhi to overrule, because the buddhi has the capacity to overrule the manas. But here is a case of using it in a negative way. Though we are sick, you know, though we get obese and we know we have to avoid sugar or fatty food, we still, you know, binge eat on that. We still go and eat that. That is because we have, that is something that possibly an animal cannot do. It cannot overrule its instinct. We have the capacity to overrule the instinct. Sadly, sometimes we use it to overrule it, to overrule the instinct in a manner that is harmful for us. We also by default don't feel like eating something when we are not healthy.
Right.
And yet we choose to overrule it and go against and eat it. Whereas this is supposed to be helpful for us to overrule in the positive way.
Right. And that's about the buddhi. And of course, as we said, for humans, the buddhi is more pronounced. The discriminating aspect of the mind is more pronounced in that sense. Next comes chitta. And this chitta is again a very interesting aspect. You know, you gave the analogy of a computer. In fact, once when we had Professor GVP sir with us, he gave this same analogy. He said, that's how I understand it. You know, you have the processor, which, you know, does the whatever process you ask it to do, and then you have these input and output signals. But there's something which it has to fall back upon, and saying that, you know, what am I supposed to do? What is the sequence I'm supposed to do it in? And that comes from the data you've stored in the hard disk. You know, be it the program or be it the OS or whatever it is, you've stored it in the hard disk. And this hard disk is something like a self-correcting system, which says that, you know, okay, I've done this, this is the mistake which has come, so let me correct it this way. The next time I will do it a little differently.
It's an evolving and learning system.
Like something like an artificial intelligence.
Mm.
And Swami says, and Vedanta says that is what is chitta. This hard disk in your mind, which starts, you know, archiving all the events which you go through, not only in this life, but in many lifetimes. So all that what you think.
So it is like, if we remove the past lifetimes, basically in the current lifetime, it is like a fund of experiences.
Right.
Based on which I make decisions. But these experiences do not remain restricted to only this lifetime. They are across lifetimes.
Right.
So, yeah. These are like influences.
Absolutely. I mean, explained. See, most of us, you know, probably let's say I have had a bad experience in a lake or in a pond. So I will have a fear of water. The next time when I'm put in a situation, I'm on a holiday and there is a swimming pool and everybody's jumping into it, I will have a hesitation. And that comes from the fear of an experience which I've had in the past. But at the same time, you'll find that in a family, you have 2 5-year-olds or a 5-year-old and 6-year-old. One child will like things in a certain manner, and the other child might, you know, probably like rock music, the other child might like some soft music. This preference comes from something which is an experience which is not in this birth, but must be from an experience of some other past birth.
Fantastic. Yeah, because we have seen this happening even with twins. Twins that are raised from the same parents in the same home with a similar, same atmosphere. Everything is same, and yet they evolve into 2 entirely different personalities. So the explanation given in the Sanatana Dharma is that it's because the chitta varies from each individual, because chitta is a total fund or storehouse of experiences. So we can say like buddhi is possibly like the RAM, and this is possibly the ROM, that is the
chitta.
But the fourth one, which Swami says is the subtlest and the most important, is the ahankara. Now, ahankara, Swami says, is the source of everything. It is the identity. It is what makes a computer a computer. You know, I don't know how to fit it into the analogy. Possibly it's the electricity that is running through the system. Because you may have a CPU, you may have a RAM, a ROM, an input device, output device. If there's no current running through, it's gone. It doesn't, I mean, I can't distinguish a microwave from a computer from a television, from a radio, everything is the same. Everything is nothing but a mass of material, a mass of matter. It is only that current that animates it and brings out the variety. So, this is fantastic. This is an example that Swami would often use even in discourses. He would say, you see so many kinds of bulbs. There's such great variety, everything. But realize that the current running through is the same. It's the same common current. So, that subtle power, that actually empowers everything. It empowers the buddhi, it empowers the chitta, it empowers the manas. It also empowers the karmendriyas and the jnanendriyas. It is this power that actually leaves and goes when we say that a person is dead. And that is this ahankara, which again can get distorted in our understanding. I mean, we shall go into that later. But ahankara is the subtlest part of the antakarana, which is the source power, which Swami says is actually the Atma or the ultimate soul, the same divinity principle that is pervading everything, which empowers the all other aspects of the mind. So that is ahankara.
There is this very interesting conversation in one of the Upanishads. I think it's the Keno Upanishad. You know? There it starts with the disciple asking this master this question. He says, very beautifully worded, he says, what makes my eyes see? What makes my ear hear? What makes my tongue speak? Okay, and probably you might say the answer is, we spoke about it, the antakarnas. But then he asks, what makes my mind think? So he says there is something which makes even this, inner processing unit, which is making all of this work together, there is something which is animating that also. So then, the master replies, it's the eye of the eye, the ear of the ear, the mind of the mind. That is what you truly are. And that's what it is in ahankara, and let's not get confused when we say the ahankara is similar or same as the atma. Swami would very beautifully say, the aham plus akara is the ahankara, and akara is the form. The moment you associate this aham, the feeling of I, with anything, with be it the body, with mind, it becomes ahankara. It says that when you think that I am this body, that becomes ahankara, but when you remove the akara, Swami says what remains is only aham. And that is what you really are, Swami says.
Beautiful. And now we can understand why, in discourses Swami would say that the mind is the grandson of the Atma.
Right.
The mind is the child of the Atma and speech is the child of the mind. Therefore, this is how Swami would draw the family tree. Here it becomes clear. There's, I think, the other analogy also from the Kathopanishad, is it? About chariot and how this antakarana has been described.
Right, I think we discussed about it once. It's a very beautiful analogy, and it puts all of these into perspective. And of course, there is another analogy which Swami gives, which shows that these are not different entities. Then it's not like your eyes, ears, and legs and hands, but it's the same thing playing different roles. The Kathopanishad analogy, of course, is that of a chariot. Where they say, the senses or the karmendriyas, or the jnanendriyas, are the horses of a chariot. Right? They are the ones which move the chariot ahead or kind of maneuver around the different paths. And then the charioteer sitting there is the buddhi.
The reins in his hand.
The charioteer is the buddhi.
Okay.
And the way he controls these horses, which are the senses, is through the reins, which is the manas.
Okay.
The working mind.
The working mind.
So it either pulls it forward or lets it go or turns the directions. All of it manages through this manas, which is the reins. And Swami says that the one who travels in this chariot is the Atma.
The master.
The master.
Just to, add on and complete this analogy to understand the antakarana, I think we would be safe in saying that the horses are the senses. The reins is the working mind or manas. Buddhi is the charioteer. And this charioteer's training and experience, the driving experience that he has gathered, knowing what should he do when this comes, what should you do when a rodam comes, what should you do when a tree comes, what should you do if the horses are tired. I think all this forms part of the chitta. Chitta or his fund of experiences into which the charioteer dips. Into whenever he needs to make a decision as to where he has to go. But we all know that the ultimate decision has to be made by the master of the chariot. The master of the chariot, which is Aham, or the I. As you said, it is very easy for anyone to get confused as to what is this. Ahankara is something that is negative, we are to shun it away. And these people are praising that as the master of the chariot who should be adhered to. So beautifully Swami has said what you brought out, saying once the akara, once you attach the I to any form, then it becomes ahankara or ego, because ego just means a wrong identification. Right. Any wrong identification is ego. So the minute this aham gets attached to any akara, the aham gets attached to any form, it becomes a wrong identification. Otherwise it's pure aham or the atma. And therefore the atma is the master of the chariot. But, you know, as we know, though the master will say this is where you have to go, the other specifics as to take a right turn here, take a left here, wait at the traffic signal, if it's right, red, don't go ahead, if it's green only go ahead, all these decisions the driver will make on his own. And all this is made based on his training and experiences. That is where chitta comes in, this fund of experiences. So I think with this the analogy becomes understandable for us. Regarding the antakarana.
Right, and going the other analogy which Swami says about these antakarnas, Swami says it's like, you know, the Brahmins, Swami gives that example of the Brahmana, you know. Everybody is a Brahmin, but the one who becomes a cook, you call him, he's a cook Brahmin. You know, there's a word.
A Brahmin cook.
There's a word in Telugu for that. Okay. Suppose he does final rites. He has a word, you know, there's a name for that. You know, he's that particular Brahmin. Or if he's a Brahmin who becomes a teacher, he becomes an Acharya Brahmin. Or one who becomes, you know, in the 3-4 this one. Swami says that, you know, it's the same Brahmin, but when he's doing different acts, he might be given different names. Swami would say it's the same thing, because the entity given to you is this thing, what you call the mind. And the mind, when it performs the act of discriminating, it becomes the buddhi. The mind, when it starts storing information, it becomes the chitta. The mind, when it starts working, it becomes the manas.
So basically, we can instead of calling it as three parts, we can make it as three functions.
Right.
Three functions of the mind.
And that which, you know, kind of puts all of this together, which kind of brings everything together, is this jal called ahankara, which kind of, you know, attaches this atma to the buddhi, to the senses. And all of it is held together by this feeling of, I am. I am this, I am that, I am all of this together.
Okay, so, it is intended to be stopping at I am, but we go ahead and make aham into ahamkara by saying I am this, I am so and so, I am a speaker, I am a writer, I am a man, I am a father, I am a whatever, I am a dash. The minute we fill in the dash, it becomes ahamkara, because there is an akara attached to that aham. The minute we stop at I am, that is why, you know, It is Swami that we turn to for every ideal example. And when Swami was asked, who are you? Swami said the right answer for this question is, I am I. Because anything else you add there, it becomes ahankara. If the minute you stop at I or I am, it becomes aham, and that is the atma. So now, this is what Swami calls as the antakarana or the innermost sense, which is animating, which is giving life, which is acting via these senses, you know, using the information from the input devices, making the input and output devices useful. It is what makes, gives life to them. In the Sandeha Nivarini, the person asking the question, which is Swami himself, of course, but through the devotee asks the next question as to Swami, is there a place where these are located? For example, where is the mind? Where is the buddhi? Where is the chitta? Where is the ahankara? You know, and Swami even gives, assigns places. Swami says the manas or the active, what do you call it as? The functional mind.
Right, the working mind.
The working mind. The working mind is located in the kapola. The kapola, you know, I was just reading through medical literature. And kapola is the place in between the ears, they say. Somewhere in the inner ear, in between the ears, which helps in keeping you balanced.
Okay.
And in Sanskrit, when you check kapola, kapola refers to the temples. you know, mm-hmm. which is almost like the same place. So that is the place of the working mind. And there itself we have got a hint as to what it should be. It should be for maintaining balance. Mm-hmm. The working mind has to maintain balance. And then Swami says the buddhi or the discrimination is residing on the tongue, Swami says.
Okay.
On the tongue. Then, not on the tongue, I mean in the tongue. And chitta. Chitta, if you need a place of residence for the chitta, it is the navel, Swami says. And again, you know, it makes so much sense because we understood chitta as the summation or the sum total of all the past experiences. In other words, it is our connection with our past. And isn't it so beautiful because it is a navel that connects us to our past, you know. Mm-hmm. Even as a baby, we receive all our nourishment from there, and when we come to the present, you know, that is our symbol of our connection to the past,
right.
The navel. That is the place for chitta, Swami says. And finally, Swami, aham, or the ahankara, Swami says, that is in the heart. So, manas in the kapola or the temple, buddhi in the tongue, chitta in the navel, ahankara or aham in the heart.
Right, and just going back to this whole idea of, you know, where we started with namaskar, and Swami saying that you bring the karmendriya and jnanendriya together, and so beautifully Swami explained in that discourse where he said the thumb should touch the, you know, the center of your chest where you believe the spiritual heart is, and then you say namaskara, and then you pay obeisance to that divinity in the other person. It only means that the adoration of the Lord should involve the, you know, your faculty of perception as well as your faculties of action. Mm-hmm. All of this should be in sync when you offer yourself at the feet of the Lord. And that is what is true namaskara. And many times Swami would say, you know, there is nothing greater in devotion than the unity of thought, word, and deed. Mm-hmm. When you're able to say that, you know, I offer myself to Swami, and that reflects in your thoughts, that reflects in your actions, that reflects in your words, that reflects in the input you get from the world outside. And all of this is in sync, and that is what is the true namaskara, which, you know, when Swami says you put your karmendriyas and jnanendriyas together and touch your heart with the thumb, which is the representation of divinity, and then you offer pranams to the divinity in front of you.
And now you see, when you say Sashtang Namaskar, in the Sashtang Namaskar, the forehead is touching the ground.
Right.
Okay, and the chin and lips are touching the ground. The chest is touching the ground. The navel is touching the ground. It just shows, and you know, the hands are folded in salutation. The legs are also put one on top of the other in salutation. You can see the eyes are closed. Everything. This is Sashtang Namaskaram, means complete Vandanam is when all the karmendriyas, jnanendriyas, and not just the input and output devices. Input and output devices just stand for what the CPU is doing. So even the antakarana, everything, when it completely bows down, that's why that complete surrender, which is, I don't know in how in any way it is lesser than complete Atmanivedanam itself. So as we have discovered, each path, when performed in the ideal manner, there is no distinction between any of the path. It is only at the superficial level, at the beginning stages, that we seem to find differences. Just like there are different starting points at the bottom of the hill, but the peak is just the same. So, once again, when we go to the peak of Vandanam, it comes to the same point of complete offering to the Lord.
But you know, that leaves you with a question that when you're talking about karmendriyas, when you're talking about your legs and your hands, you're talking about your nose, and the sensation of touch and all of this. We know that all of this, especially when you talk of sense organs, you know, when Swami says control your sense organs, a little bit of vilification of the sense organ is there because I think in our mind we have this feeling the sense organ is meant for worldly activities. So where does spirituality come into this? When you say you use your sense organs to offer obeisance to the Lord, the question is where does this merger of your worldly activities and the spiritual action come together? And in fact, that again Swami gives a beautiful example through this act of namaskar. And that's another interpretation when Swami says what it means by putting your two hands together. So I think we'll listen to that discourse clip. This is again from a Sammukha's discourse, but in 2000, 22nd of May 2000.
విద్యార్థులారా,
స్టూడెంట్స్,
విద్యార్థినియులారా,
బాయ్స్ అండ్ గర్ల్స్,
చదువుతున్నారు,
యు స్టడీ,
దేనికోసం చదువుతున్నారు,
వై డు యు స్టడీ,
ఉద్యోగాల కోసం చదువుతున్నారు,
ఫర్ జాబ్ యు లెర్న్,
ఉద్యోగాలు కూడా అవసరమే,
జాబ్స్ ఆర్ నెసెసరీ,
ప్రాకృత విద్యలు,
దట్స్ వరల్డ్లీ నాలెడ్జ్,
అది లౌకిక విద్యలు,
ఫిజికల్ నాలెడ్జ్, సెక్యులర్ నాలెడ్జ్,
భౌతిక విద్యలు,
సెక్యులర్ నాలెడ్జ్,
కానీ దానితో పాటు సాంస్కృతిక విద్యలు కూడా మనం ప్రయత్నించాలి,
అలాంగ్ విత్ ది వరల్డ్లీ నాలెడ్జ్ యు హావ్ టు హావ్ ది స్పిరిచువల్ నాలెడ్జ్,
అది ఏ శ్రేయో మార్గము,
ది స్పిరిచువల్ నాలెడ్జ్ ఇస్ ప్రేయర్, వరల్డ్లీ నాలెడ్జ్ ఇస్ ప్రేయర్,
ప్రతి మానవుడికి కూడా రెండు ఉంటున్నాయి,
ఎవ్రీ మ్యాన్ హ్యాస్ టూ,
అది లెఫ్ట్ అండ్ రైట్,
లెఫ్ట్ అండ్ రైట్,
ఈ రెండు చేతులు ఇచ్చిందే దేనికోసమని,
వై టూ హ్యాండ్స్ ఆర్ గివెన్,
ఈ రెండు ద్వారా నీకు పనిచేసి రెండింటి యొక్క ఏకత్వం చేతనే పనిచేయాలి,
యు వర్క్ విత్ బోత్ హ్యాండ్స్ ఇన్ పర్ఫెక్ట్ హార్మోనీ,
అనేక పర్యాయాలను మీకు చెప్పాను,
భగవాన్ సెడ్ మెనీ టైమ్స్,
ఎందుకోసం మనం నమస్కారం చేస్తున్నాము,
వై డు వి నమస్కార,
ఈ రెండు చేతులు ఎందు 10 వేళ్లు ఉన్నాయి,
అండ్ ది టూ హ్యాండ్స్ హావ్ గాట్ ది 10 ఫింగర్స్,
ఇది ధర్మ మార్గమునకు ఇచ్చేటువంటిది,
వన్ ఇస్ ఆఫ్ ధర్మ,
ఇది ప్రపంచక ధర్మం కోసం ఇచ్చేది,
అదర్ ఇస్ ఫర్ ద వరల్డ్,
ఇది 5 వేళ్లు,
ఐదు
ఏకత్వం చేయటమే నమస్కారము,
జాయిన్ బోత్ హ్యాండ్స్ ద 10 ఫింగర్స్ దట్ ఇస్ నమస్కార,
ఏకత్వం గావించటమే నమస్కారము,
దిస్ యూనిఫైయింగ్ థింగ్ ఇస్ నమస్కార,
భిన్నత్వం గావించకూడదు,
నాట్ డైవర్సిఫికేషన్,
చాలా మంది ఇప్పుడు అంతా నమస్కారం అండి నమస్కారం అండి అంటుంటారు,
పీపుల్ డూ నమస్కారం విత్ వన్ హ్యాండ్,
ఏమిటి అటు పెట్టుకుని తలగొట్టుకోవటం,
యు ఆర్ ఓన్లీ హిట్టింగ్ యువర్ హెడ్ దట్స్ ఆల్,
వాడి కర్మకు వాడు తలగొట్టుకుంటున్నాడు,
యు ఆర్ జస్ట్ రిపెంటింగ్ ఫర్ యువర్ డెస్టినీ,
నమస్కారము నమస్కారం, నమ అహంకారం లేనటువంటిదే నమస్కారం,
ద వర్డ్ నమస్కార మెంట్ ద స్టేట్ ఆఫ్ ఈగోలెస్నెస్,
అహంకారం ఉండకూడదు,
దేర్ షుడ్ నాట్ బి ఎన్ ఈగో,
నమ అనగా నేను కాదు,
నమ
మమ అనగా నేను,
ఐఎమ్ నాట్
మమ అనేటువంటి దాన్ని నేను కాదు, నమమా నేను కాదు,
యువర్ ఈగోలెస్నెస్ ఐ అబ్సెన్స్ ఆఫ్ ఐనెస్,
ఈ అహంకారం ఉండినంత వరకు మానవుని అతపతనం చేస్తుంటుంది,
ఈగో నేచురల్లీ రూయిన్స్ యు.
Well, that's two of the interpretations which we often used to listen from Swami, where you know, Namaskaram, bringing together Shreyas and prayers, or the union of the worldly and the spiritual path in your your Vandanam to the Lord. You know, when you bring both of this together, when it is in sync, because Swami would say that you can't stop eating because you've become a spiritual person. A beautiful analogy, you know, when you're talking about the senses, we're talking about the sense of smell, we're talking about how important it is. We don't realize that it's because of the sense of smell, most of the time we come to know whether the food is edible or not. And in fact, that is one of the key functions of the smell, the sense of smell. When you smell an object, you're supposed to know, okay, this is good for this body. Because this body is the temple of the Lord, it is good for the body, so I can take it. Of course, we misuse it in many ways, it's a different thing. But that is what the sense of smell is meant for. And similarly, you know, Swami would say that is the prayers part. You have to use the senses for the welfare of the body. But the shreyas part is, why should you keep the body intact? It is to serve the Lord. It is to reach this ultimate goal of humankind. And Swami would say that, as Swami was telling in that clip, when you bring the shreyas and prayers together, and then use both to offer yourself at the Lord's feet. Removing the namaskar, again, that beautiful part where Swami says, na mama is, you know, namaha.
That was really fantastic, because that is what it is coming to. See, we also realized that aham is what we have to strive for, ahankara we have to give up. So Swami says, mama is ahankara, nama is just I am I, staying with the aham. Another byproduct of this kind of thought process is, when you said that all the senses, all the karmendriyas, jnanendriyas are given so that we maintain the body and this apparatus well. But that is just the prayer or the worldly path. The Shreya or the higher path is, why on earth should I maintain this body well? It's because it has to serve the Lord. That is the that is the Shreya Marga, that is the higher Marga. And that is why we can see how a person committing suicide is often looked down upon. At the same time, a person sacrificing his life for the sake of society is looked up to. Both have actually willfully killed themselves. But if you can see, one person has violated the guidelines given to the senses of protecting the body for the sake of the Shreya Marga, for the sake of, you know, taking him a step closer to God, for doing a noble deed. That's why it is praised, because though it's a violation of the guideline, it is being violated for a Shreya Marga. In the same way here, a person is violating the guidelines, but for, you know, what it is not for the Shreya Marga or not for something that is going to take you closer to God. Yeah, it may be depression, frustration, irritation, whatever. So therefore it is looked down upon. Though technically both have done the same thing, which is consciously taken, given up their life. One is praised, made a hero. If done in army, we even give Paramvir Chakra, we give awards. While the other, whatever, however great a person he or she might be, when they commit suicide, we just sympathize and say, sorry, great man, but he should not have done this. You know, that itself shows as to the Shreya and Preya Marga, as to one is the goal that the senses have, which is protecting this apparatus, but we should, in pursuing that goal, we should never forget that there's a higher goal, and that goal we get by answering the question, why should we protect this apparatus?
And talking about Ahankara, Swami was saying that, Swami would say this, you know, most of our Namavalis, I'm sorry, the Ashtotrams will always end with Namaha.
Namaha.
You know, Namah Shivaya, or you know, all of...
Om Shri Sat Sai Bhavaya Namaha, Namaha. Om Shri Sat Sai Swarupaya Namaha.
So Swami would say that it is like you're saying that Bhagwan Shri Sat Sai Bhavaya Na Mama, which means not me but He. Namah Shivaya means not me, it is Shiva within me. So, and again going back to the Ahankara, we often talk of Ahankara as what I associate my being with, right? You know, I am the body, I think, so that is Ahankara. But if I'm looking at you and saying that you are the body, even that is also a form of Ahankara. So Swami is saying that you beat both of this in the form of Vandanam. Because I am greeting the divinity within you, I am trying to overlook this apparatus which is obvious to the eye, which is, you know, which has a personality, which has a nature. I'm trying to look beyond that and look at the Lord within, at the same time hoping that that will enable me to look beyond this body which I am and look at the divinity within.
I think that is where we have been led to so beautifully by Swami, that the true Vandanam or Namaskar happens when wholeheartedly with the Karmendriyas, with the Jnanendriyas coming together at our heart which is the seat of the Aham, the true identity of ourselves, and with the tongue. You know, this is another interesting thing that Swami tells in the Sandeha Nivarini. The tongue which says Namaskar, as we already discussed, this is supposed to be a discussion going on between a devotee and Swami, both which Swami has only authored. So the devotee then says that, therefore, Swami, the most important are the buddhi and ahankara. Because buddhi is on the tongue and ahankara is on the heart. In the heart, Swami says, perfect. And Swami says, how well your buddhi has developed. You know, how discriminating you are. And this is not discrimination in a negative sense. This is not like racial discrimination or caste-based discrimination. This is discrimination between dharma, adharma, good and bad. So, how good discriminating you are is shown... A symptom of that, it is represented best by the way you speak. From the way you speak, you can understand what kind of discrimination do you have. Are you loose-tongued? Are you quick-tongued? You know, are you foul-mouthing? It only shows lack of discrimination on your part. Do you speak sweetly? Do you speak politely? Do you always speak the truth? It then just shows how good your buddhi is, how good your discrimination power is. So, that is another nice insight that Swami gives there. And therefore, when we say Namaskara, Swami says it involves the tongue, which is the buddhi, which means our discrimination we are offering, which means our discrimination is going to be based in such a manner that we always select Shreyas over Preyas. Then the Aham, which is we are able to recognize the divinity within. Then we have brought together the Karmendriyas, Jnanendriyas together, and then we offer ourselves. So this, I think this is a most comprehensive kind of definition that we can ever arrive at for Vandanam.
You know, whenever I think about this particular path, there's one bhajan which always used to come to my mind, and I would say that this kind of, you know, describes this entire journey which we were speaking about. When we started last week, we said there is another meaning for Vandanam, which also means to sing the praise of the Lord. You know, you're going to Kirtanam. The prayer book which students usually refer to is called the Vandana book. Right? So Vandanam also means that you're offering prayers to the Lord, or you're worshipping the Lord. And, you know, there is this beautiful bhajan which we sing, which is the second Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam, not the original which Swami sings. You know, right. There, you know, it starts with, first you, Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam. you worship the Lord. That's a form of vandanam. And the second line of that bhajan is Nirmala Hridaya Virajita Charanam. So what happens when you start worshipping the Lord? Your heart starts getting purified. And Swami would say this, you know, all spiritual practices are meant for Chitta Shuddhi. Your mind starts getting purified. Your mind starts getting clarified.
If I can pause you over here, see, this makes so much sense, because as you said, the overall direction, final destination is given by the Aham, that is the master of the chariot. But the entire driving through is done by the Buddhi, that is the discrimination, the driver. And we said that the driver relies on his training and experience.
Right.
Therefore, how important it is that that training and experience be good. That is the chitta. That is the fund on which he depends. And therefore, all our sadhana should be towards chitta shuddhi. Because if we purify that, if our training and experience is perfect, then, you know, there is no chance of our buddhi leading us haywire. We will be definitely always on the path towards the destination as commanded by the master or Atma.
Right, and that's what happens when, you know, when this second line of the bhajan says Nirmala Hridaya. You know, your heart becomes purified, then Nirmala Hridaya Virajita Charanam. That same Lord whom you worship becomes the emperor of your heart. And now the Lord whom you worshipped outside, you feel that, oh, he is within me. And the moment you start seeing him within you, you know, you go to the next stage where you
Sakala
Charachara Vyapaka Charanam. Now that Lord who is inside me, I'm seeing him all around me. So every person you see, you greet him, you greet the person inside him. You greet her, you greet that Lord within her. So you go to that third stage where you're seeing the Lord everywhere outside. And the last line of the bhajan says, Bhavasagara Uddharaka Charanam. And this is the way you actually get liberated from this feeling of, you know, you're this limited self.
Beautiful. I think if it is possible, it would be beautiful to conclude this satsang with that very bhajan. So dear listeners, we have made our little attempt at trying to understand and glean from Swami's literature. It has been a very, very enlightening experience for both of us, and we hope that it has been the same with you. We would love to, you know, receive your feedback, share your ideas, your thoughts on this, or yes, any other matter in general. With this, we will be concluding our discussion on Vandanam, which is the fifth mode of worship in the Navvade Bhakti Marga. The next fortnight is our Ramkatha Rasavahini fortnight. We will be going back to the Ramkatha, after which, in the coming fortnight after that, we will go to the next part, which is Archanam. So till then, let us keep singing his glory, thinking of him, feeling his love in our hearts, feeling him every moment of our lives, and ensuring that our love for him grows stronger every passing moment of our life. And in order to help in that, here is that bhajan which Prem mentioned about. Let's listen and enjoy to that. On the other side of the bhajan will be the segment Love to Love.
Mahanasa bhajare. Thank you. మురళి మనోహర ఆశాన తోడో, మురళి మనోహర ఆశాన తోడో,
మురళి మనోహర ఆశాన తోడో,
దుఃఖ భంజన మేరా సాథ న
చోడో,
भंजन मेरा साथ न छोड़ो,
भंजन मेरा साथ न छोड़ो,
द्वार खड़ा हूँ मैं दुखिया रा,
द्वार खड़ा हूँ मैं दुखिया,
द्वार खड़ा हूँ मैं दुखिया रा,
साईं बाबा।